Stevenson. I'm Tom O'Connell. This is my wife, Annie Ludlum. And we will be talking about Emily Dickinson with you and having you react to some of her poems through the rest of this week. Last week, I taught some classes and we talked about Emily Dickinson's poetry itself. And Annie did a series of sessions about another 19th century lady called Fanny Kemble and talked about theater. Annie is an actress and I am a teacher in Seattle. And we have some material here. We brought along a bunch of books, lots of books, which are for your delectation and delight. As the day goes on, you can look at them after the class. You're welcome to borrow any of them if you wish. There is some other material on this table, including some copies of columns, newspaper columns about Emily Dickinson that I've written from time to time, and we'll be referring to some of this material. What we want to do is to have you gain a sense of how an artist like Emily Dickinson, a poet, who wrote poems on pieces of paper, 1,775 of them to be precise, how the art that she practiced all her life can be and has been translated into other art forms, including the most obvious one of all, which we'll be talking about today, which is the oral presentation of her art. She wrote poems as all poets do, not necessarily just to be seen on the piece of paper that she wrote, but also to be sounded aloud. How does it sound? Was always in her mind, and always is in the mind of any good poet. Poetry is meant to be read aloud. And to read it aloud to yourself is to gain another dimension of appreciation beyond that which you get simply by looking at it and reflecting on how it might sound. So we'll be doing some saying of her poems. She was a poet who, among her other virtues, was extremely concise, was extremely economical in her poems. There were never any extra words. Part of the fun of poetry is to see how concise one can get, and nobody was a better artist at concision than Emily Dickinson. Edgar Allan Poe, who was a poet writing at the same time she was, said, "There is no such thing as a long poem." A poem, by definition, is short. It's got to be concise. One of the differences between poetry and prose is that poetry does condense, does make its thoughts spare, and uses words sparingly. There are two other characteristics of poetry that she embodies, and we hope you will come to appreciate in her art. And indeed, there's a point where they meet in her poetry. One is the use of metaphor, and the other is the use of humor. And they go very close together. Metaphor is having something represent something else, having something stand for something else, making comparisons. Indeed, anthropologists tell us that when primitive man found ways to compare one thing with another, it was a leap forward in the mental development of human beings, comparable to the development which took place physically when man first stood up so that he had his hands free, his forepaws free to manipulate and develop tools. And either before or after that, there's some difference of opinion on this, maybe we've got some anthropologists here who will straighten this out, but I've read several accounts on the difference of opinion, either before or after man stood up and saw and was able then to free his forepaws, his eyes, I say his generically, since the development of man, came forward so that he was able to focus and see things in depth as most animals cannot in the same measure that we can. That was just an enormous step forward in the development of man's capacity to function and to commence to reason. And then another giant step forward was when man saw that you can compare things with another. Is this harder or softer, larger or smaller, older or newer? We're getting into a subtle conversation. And poets are the best users of metaphor in the language, because language, metaphor is the stuff of language. There is a point in good use of metaphor where the metaphor, the comparison, is so fresh and so different, so new, that we see it, we perceive it as a surprise. And when it is surprising, what else is it? When something really surprises you, what's your reaction?
Excited.
You're excited. Mm-hmm. Right. What else are you?
Startled.
You're startled.
Enlightened.
Stimulated.
You're stimulated. What might your reaction be emotionally? What might you do if you find something really surprising?
Some scare.
Mm-hmm. Pleasure. Yeah. This is what I was looking for, was pleasure and laughter. It's funny. It's funny. And indeed, the two aspects of our lives that react most to humorous things, the thing that makes things funny is that they are surprising. And surprise is the essence of poetry also. So poetry and humor go hand in hand. And the thing that brings them closest together is the element of surprise. Emily Dickinson followed Emerson's words in a poem that he wrote, where he said, poetry should climb to success by the stairway of surprise. So by the use of metaphor, we are surprised, and we are delighted, and we are startled, and we find pleasure, and Emily Dickinson combines those factors. Her metaphors are surprising and funny and delightful and startling. We're startled by insights. She one time said that the way she could tell a poem was a true poem was if it made her feel as though the top of her head had been taken off. Whoosh! You ever had that happen to you? I can't believe that insight. It was so startling, astounding. The perception is beyond what I could never imagine. That's part of the fun of Emily Dickinson. And a lot of these qualities in poetry are enhanced if we hear the words aloud. And even more if we ourselves read them aloud. The way to treat a poem is to read it aloud. And that's what we want to have you do some of today. And what we'll be doing the rest of the week will be relating a lot of our poetry to being read aloud. We've got some audio tapes, we've got some video tapes, we've got some copies of scripts of material and advertisements for material that we've seen and used in Emily Dickinson's poetry being adapted for musical presentation in song and instruments, in dance, in video presentations. Tomorrow we'll show a video presentation about her life that uses some of her art in a 1990s way to show it on the screen, in films, and in theater. Annie has directed a production over in the Seattle area of The Belle of Amherst, a wonderful play written about her that some of you may have seen, which was itself adapted for television and shown on television with Julie Harris playing the role of Emily Dickinson, a one-person play. Annie directed it with an old Holden Village standby, Ruth McCree, who's known to some of you.
Middle-aged.
Old in the sense of old hand. She's a relatively young woman. So we want to share with you this week, having last week paid most attention to the poems themselves, the language of the poems themselves, we want not to lose track of that. And it's not that these sessions are to be exclusive of treatment of the poems themselves. Indeed, if that's your bent, we'll do some of that, because we want the sessions in a measure to be responsive to your wishes, but we do want to try to expand from the treatment of the body of Emily Dickinson's work, which I treated last week, to talk about the art which can flow from that magnificent body of poetry, which those of you who were with me last week have heard me say more than once, I think is the best body of poetry that any poet has produced in America. So let's move forward to talking about the language of poetry, and Annie, would you take the lead on that?
Yes, let me first have one footnote.
Sure.
For your opening comments. One is that we will show tomorrow night a video, not about Emily Dickinson, but about the person that I was dealing with last week that Tom mentioned, Fanny Kemble, who was a little-known great woman in American history. She was a 19th century English writer and actress who married a North American and went to live on his plantations in Georgia in the 1830s and wrote a wonderful journal about her observations of living on a slave plantation in Georgia. Many people consider it the best eyewitness account of life on a slave plantation. And the video that we will show tomorrow is a script which I helped to co-write. It's based on a play which I did write, and it's filmed in Georgia. Some of the scenes are actually the very sites that are mentioned in her journal. And in it, I play Fanny Kemble. It was made several years ago by Georgia State University and shown on PBS. And her journal is available in the library here, and also there's a new edition of it in the bookstore. So that's a footnote to the Fanny Kemble.
What time is it tomorrow?
6:20. And Verlin Brown, the village pastor, and I are going to have a brief discussion of it afterwards. He's particularly interested in the implications of what Fanny Kemble saw in 1838 for us today as North Americans and how we behave.
As usual, when Verlin sees something like that, he's got some insights that are really worth sharing.
Yeah.
He attended most of my sessions last week on Emily Dickinson, and his questions and his observations were right there.
Verlin Brown is the village pastor, for those of you who are newly arrived.
If you haven't got to know him, you should try to get to know him.
He's the person who, as he says, does not look like a Viking.
Is this going to be over in the village? Or?
That's going to be in the room next door at 6:20. Yeah.
I should mention, Annie, if I may,
yes.
This is in the nature of a plug. The best selection of her poems is Final Harvest. This is the version that I have used. And a later edition of the very same book is this Final Harvest version, which is available in the Holden Village Library in the bookstore, and we highly commend it to your use. If you really like her poetry, this is the best of the selections of her poetry. Also have here, by the same scholar who produced this selection, her complete poems. This is the whole works. We used it a little bit.
Well, it's an artifact of my experiences with Emily Dickinson working in theater with her. Not only did I direct The Belle of Amherst, but then I directed a couple of other things which Ruth McCree, the person who played in Belle of Amherst, has come up with. One is a script she wrote herself, which is but shorter than the Belle of Amherst, and is basically about the poetry, called A Visit with Emily. And Ruth tours that play a lot on the East Coast. She's now done 4 tours on the East Coast, and occasionally in the Pacific Northwest too, where we live. And she's also done a program for the radio, for National Public Radio, in which Ruth reads poetry, and we had original music composed to go with the poetry. And we'll play that for you later in the week. It runs 8 minutes. And then also Ruth did a concert with a singer, and the singer sang songs based on Emily Dickinson poetry, and Ruth read poems. And so the book has gotten, you know, a lot of use in putting together these various programs and plays and so forth, because you have to use the book when you do it. As a result, obviously, of my experiences as a theater person working with Emily Dickinson material, I think a wonderful way to get to know the poems is to do them, to perform them, because then you are absolutely forced to pay attention to what's going on inside the poem. So I want to try a little workshop situation today that will not be onerous, but I think it will help us to get to that place where we can attack a poem as material to be performed. So I thought it would be fun if everybody just thinks of a line of poetry, from any poet. It can be from a nursery rhyme or...
I think that I shall never see, for example.
That's right. That was said at the staff meeting last week. The whole poem was said, actually. So just think of a line of poetry, and then what you should do, and what everybody should do, and what I think we should take part in this too, and we should probably think of a line from Emily Dickinson, so now we better do it.
Can't think of a line of poetry, think of an aphorism.
A stitch in time.
A stitch in time saves nothing.
It can be a line of a song, a song lyric. Okay, has everybody got a line? Everybody got a line?
Robert.
I'm not going to help you.
Yeah, ask somebody to think of something they can't think of because you've asked them to think about it. Just think for a minute and think of something.
Think of something from
Robert Burns.
Oh, yeah. Robert Burns. Got reams of Robert Burns in his head, I know. All Scotsmen do. So do you have a line? Everybody got a line? Okay, now we all have to go around and we have to encounter everybody else in the room, and we have to give our line of poetry to that person and receive a line of poetry from the other person, okay?
We just might say that lest you get so carried away with the delivery of your line that you don't hear what the other person says, you're only doing half the job, because we'd like you to sort of hear what the other person says too. So it's a dual responsibility to deliver your line any way you wish, with variety or the same way every time, whatever, but also to hear what the other person says.
Should we demonstrate?
Let me demonstrate.
Okay. B, I'm expecting you.
I'm nobody. Who are you?
Now, I think what I'm going to try to do is go around and say that line in different ways to different people.
Okay, I'll say mine in different ways to different people. Okay. Let's all stand up and we'll just move around here and just say those lines to everybody. I'm nobody. Who are you?
Have we all greeted? Did everybody get a breath? Okay, now, let's go around the room, and everybody say a line that was said to you.
And we're not interested in the precision of the language as much as we're interested in the expression that you want to give to the line, whatever it be. That's the thing. If you can't get it exactly right, that's not so important.
Okay, so I'm going to start, because it's really an amazing thing. Laden Macon.
I was thinking.
No, but when I was a little girl. We had a housekeeper who was German named Bertha Atkinson, who's married to an American. And she taught me to knit. And she used to say that to me because when I would sew and turn and put on, you know, sew on buttons when I was pretty little, so I would, you know, thread the thread and get a long thread so I'd never have to thread it again. And so, I mean, I still try to do that, which is really ridiculous. And I hear her, you know, but I didn't know what she was saying. So that's great. So you gave me a phrase in my mind. And it's interesting. Gelanges Maken, Faules Faken.
Oh, if there are any Germans in here, you're going to hate me. Because my pronunciation is so horrible.
But it's the, you know, for me it isn't the words, it's the sentiment. And it invokes a whole, you know, place and room and sunlight and a sound of a person and the feel of a person who's very dear to me. So that's lovely. Ah.
Yeah, I can't recall it very well. I'm familiar with it. It's the evening star and passing far.
Yeah, who said that?
And,
I was going to say that too.
When you put a ball or something, maybe you can say it.
May there be no moaning at the bar.
Yeah, why don't you say, just say it out loud so we can all hear it.
May there be no moaning at the bar when I put out to sea.
Yeah. Can everybody hear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did you get?
Under the spreading chestnut tree in the village.
Smithy.
Yeah. And who gave that to you? Yeah.
Humpty Dumpty Barrel.
You're right. What did you get?
There's something about a wall.
Oh, who gave you that?
I think it was Betty.
Oh, I guess I didn't greet you, Betty.
And I've been feeling like I've got a wall. I've been feeling so lousy all of the day, and it was a perfect one.
And what was your response?
Well, how do you like to go up in the swing?
Yeah. Those are nice together, aren't they? Two images that are, that really work together very nicely.
Yeah.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Who gave you that? Great. So, Betty.
I guess I had to repeat there, sunset and evening star. That too brought back a lot of memories of early poetry and memorizing poetry. And just a real good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give the one liner here. The golf course lies so near the mill that nearly every day the children can look out and see the men at play.
Little social conscience.
Terrible.
Haunting one.
The image of those boys working in the factory.
That's what I'm
going to
say.
Yeah, that's right. Awful, isn't it?
You want me to tell you what Jan said?
Yes.
He said, the fog came in on little cat feet.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And I think we're sort of around to you in the turquoise shirt.
Yeah.
Well, this person, he just said my line.
Oh,
you can say it. Oh, you can
say it. Say it too.
Oh, well, I won't.
Oh, but you can.
I think, B, are you coming soon?
Oh, yeah.
So my mother is Beatrice, so I immediately think of my own mother when I hear the word bee.
Great. Terrific. Terrific. Yes.
To be or not to be.
Uh-huh.
I saw him once before as I passed by the door.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's Robert Frost.
I think it's Whittier.
Oh,
I think so. It's Whittier.
It's Whittier.
And I was going to say also, to be or not to be.
Yeah.
I think I remember Don's the best of being a woman at the bar.
Isn't that interesting?
I think it was his loud, decisive voice that made me remember it.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And what did you get? What do you remember from the ones we said to you?
I'm nobody. Who are you?
The world is charged with grandeur.
Who said that?
Jen.
Ah.
She never actually said it to me, but I overheard it.
No. Jen, what did you get?
The fall came in on Little Cat's paws because it made such a nice follow-up to the world being charged with grandeur of God. I thought, lovely contrast.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting how things work together.
I did a Burns.
Yes, do your Burns again. So we can all...
We want his crimson tippet floor, thou's met him in evil look, but I am uncrushed and unobscure, I surrender stand.
Now do it so everybody can tell. Yeah.
Thank you, Gil.
Yeah. Just try it louder.
Be modest, crimson tippet flower, thou's met me in an evil hour, for I am uncrushed among the steward, thy slender stand.
Yeah.
Among the steward, among the dirt. It's a poet, Burns' poet to a daisy. When he plowed it under one day. He then goes on to compare, it's quite an interesting comparison, he then goes on to compare the daisy to the lasses of the town.
Oh. So why don't you give it once more, now that we know what it's about and have the image.
We are modest.
It's a very moving couple of lines. You just see the regret, the feeling of regret. Reminds me of a comparable poet, Robert Frost wrote about, you may remember, going out to the field, which had been scythed, had been cut, and finding a little tuft of flowers that had obviously been carefully left by the person who went before, cutting everything down. But the previous person had also observed this beautifully framed and located little clump of extraordinarily pretty wildflowers, and had gone out of his or her way to leave them there, and how much the poet appreciated that act. That's one of his earliest poems. Indeed, I think that's the first poem he ever sent to the Tuft of Flowers, to a publisher, to see if he could get it published. The regret that Burns felt, and the elation that Frost felt, first for having cut down the flower, and then for somebody having the kindness, the forethought, to leave the flower.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look at an Emily Dickinson poem.
Everybody ready?
Yeah. You'll never guess what it is.
I'm nobody.
Right.
Some of the stuff.
You looked.
I know. I did that. You looked at
me. So let's just go through it line by line, okay? I'm nobody. Who are you? I'm nobody. Which, of course, is a ridiculous thing to say because everybody's somebody.
Yes, but when people are feeling very diffident, very uncertain, they're liable to say something like, I'm nobody. Well, he's the president of the company and he's the treasurer and she's the vice president. Oh, I'm nobody.
Right. So this is a shy person's poem.
This is a Garrison Keillor type poem. So it's on nobody. Who are you? Are you a kin's person? Are you like me, just another Joe, another Jill? Are you nobody too? Oh, bonding in this pair of us. I don't have to worry that you're a person with so much space that you're gonna put me down. There's a pair of us. We told them we're nobody. They'd start to tell everybody that we're nobody, that we're not even a vice president. But on the other hand, now that you and I are alone, we can talk confidentially.
It's hard really to be alone.
Oh, how dreary to be somebody. Can you imagine being somebody and having to puff yourself up all the time?
Get dressed, wear lipstick, put on stockings.
Wear carry gloves.
Wear a hat.
How dreary to be somebody, how public like a frog, tell one's name the livelong June to an admiring fog.
Isn't that a great idea? It's sort of Mr. Toad in Wind in the Willows. He's a frog, and he leads this kind of life, which is very dreary to the people who don't lead it.
Yeah. This could be Mowgli, really, talking about his attitude toward Toadie.
Right.
Yeah.
Wasn't a frog rather flamboyant, though?
He was flamboyant, right. And he got into all kinds of trouble.
Toad was, yeah. Toad and frog are both
different. They're both different. Yeah,
We're putting it together, right? And we're moving across from prose to poetry to prose, and from an American writer to an English writer. That's okay, because we see the kinsmanship. This is often perceived as a kind of an emblematic poem of Emily Dickinson's diffidence about being published. She never really was sure whether she should be published or not. And the side of her was this very diffident, spinster, shy woman living a recluse's life who didn't really want all that furor and fame that came to Emerson and other poets that she admired, but who had to have a persona that they projected. And she just wanted to be herself and stay at home. So this poem is that side of her that said, I'm nobody, and who liked to be somebody. But the metaphor she uses is typical Dickinson, whimsical, humorous, kind of cute, very accessible poem. All of her poems are not that accessible, accessible in the sense that you and I, almost anybody, can just read it and know what's happening in the poem pretty much. You can get the irony, I think, of a little kid. I've read this poem to little kids. They get the irony here very quickly. It's very accessible. A lot of her poems, which are as concise as this, are chock full, and then we're going to have to do some little puzzle solving in order to see what she was getting at. But this one, I think, is pretty accessible, and is that much more fun when we project it, when we say it aloud. And there are lots of different ways to say it, right? You can play a kind of a different role as you say it. Somebody want to read it?
You mentioned little kids, and I could just see it. Oh, big husky little kid feeling lonely and calling out to someone, I'm nobody, who are you?
Read it that way. So see how the lines go if you're playing that persona.
These kids that try to get attention of other kids, but instead of being nice, they just sort of bully up. I'm nobody. Hey, who are you? Are you nobody too? Well, then there's a pair of us. But don't tell. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. It's dreary to be somebody. How public. It's like a frog. To tell one's name the livelong June to an admiring bog.
That's great.
That's very good.
Child would use those words.
Let's put you, let's put at the head of the class. Talking with somebody.
I believe early tradition.
So we'll get your presentation right up front.
Come here. Now you're somebody.
No. Now your teacher's a bad.
Sorry, I said.
No. And you come to.
I've been reading too many children's books.
I haven't done anything.
Yeah.
I'm nobody.
Okay. Good.
That's why she picked you, because you're nobody too.
Just sit there being nobody.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And you sit there, and all the rest of you get together and be somebody.
Hey, I'm nobody. Who are you?
Are you nobody too? No, you want you were on the stage.
That's okay. That's okay. Just go ahead and do it that way.
Let's see. Don't tell. They'd advertise.
Yeah.
They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How puppets like a frog.
Like a frog, yeah. To tell one's name, a live long June.
To the admiring bog.
Very good. That's nice.
Well, I've got my frog shirt on, you see.
There you go.
I think we should have everybody find a poem.
Why doesn't everybody find a poem? And one place that you can look is, let's see, we just got three copies. These are the poems that I used last week, and these are just happen to be the remaining copies. Some of you have them, though, right? There's one. Why don't we just spread these around? And
everybody have a poem he or she likes?
That one I don't understand.
That's okay. It's all right.
That's the best kind.
That's
the best kind. Okay. The first thing to do, I think, is simply to read the poem out loud. And so why don't we just go around the room and have everybody read the poem out loud. And don't worry about getting all the meaning in, but you know, sort of say it and let it talk to you at the same time that you're saying it out loud. Just be alert to it.
Yeah, one
don't
thing.
Don't perform it.
Please. Don't perform it. One of the things that you might be thinking of as you read it is, as you read it aloud, you will find that it will help you to understand it. And so as you read it, particularly if you're having trouble understanding some lines, just read the lines in a way that you think will help you to understand them, namely just kind of probing.
And as you read, if you're over there, read the poem to me, and if you're over there, read the poem to Tom. And that will help you to project. Just think of the fact that we have to get it. We don't have it in front of us. So we have to get the poem. We have to get all the words.
Yeah, we have to hear it all. Right.
So let's just start over here. Yeah.
I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry. The breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witness in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me, and then the windows failed, and then I could not see the sea.
Yeah, nice poem. Any questions about the actual meaning of it? What's happening?
I understand.
Yeah, it's really clear. Really nice.
I mean,
yeah. It happens to be one that you wouldn't know that I read at Vespers the other night.
Oh.
Right.
But you read it with really good clarity, just as I was trying to get.
She capitalizes various letters and words in here. And I was wondering, like windows, and then the windows failed.
She was
I could not see.
Yeah, she was somewhat capricious in her capitalization, but it always meant something.
Well, I wondered the double meaning of the windows.
Yeah, windows.
It could be her eyes,
Or both. Well, see,
I mean,
both. Right.
I mean, yeah, both.
Both. Then all of a sudden it starts to get dark, and is it those windows or these windows start to fail? This was a 19th century custom, as you probably know, an American custom, particularly in the 19th century, that if we all had a friend who was dying, we might very well go over to her house when the MD said that this is probably just right around the corner is death. And we'd go there in order to witness the king coming into the room, the king being death, to watch that momentous cataclysmic event. So they're seated there with a kind of eagerness and an almost obscene curiosity from Emily Dickinson's point of view. And what happens? A fly? It's just a fly, just a plain, ordinary blowfly. A kind of hateful thing comes in the room. So So it's a, this is a poem that's charged with irony.
Yeah, it's like the king versus the Grim Reaper.
Right.
Well, could there be a double meaning in the king? The king, the king is victor of Christ, the king, as well as the devil.
Yes, indeed.
Not the devil, but death. I don't know, king.
Yes, indeed.
And the room is capitalized.
Yeah, so the room.
Could be the upper room.
Could be the upper room. Yes, indeed. Good for you.
Yeah. Also, the word blue and buzz are capitalized. Of the fly.
Yes.
Uncertain, stumbling buzz.
Bzzz.
Between the light and me.
Yeah, it's one that is often anthologized, is often taught because it has such a wonderfully sardonic, ironic, almost she really lets the custom have it without pulling her punches. It's a very strong poem, I think.
Yeah,
very strong poem.
Yeah. Let's just go around.
Thy chivalry's this
tiny. I need it louder.
Thy chivalry's this tiny, the blossom or a book. The seeds of smiles are planted, which blossom in the dark.
I need it again. I don't know this poem. I only know them if they're in the plays that I've directed. So.
Thy chivalry's as tiny, a blossom or a book. The seeds of smiles are planted, which blossom in the dark.
Oh, isn't that nice? Mm. What a great poem to put with a while you're sending a blossom or a book. Yeah.
Which is how she used it. She sent that poem to a friend with a present. Oh. That's what she often did when she would send, because she kept her friendships even when she became a recluse. She was a total recluse and didn't even leave her room for months and months, to say nothing going out on the street. But she still kept up her relationships. She kept her friendships in good repairs, Samuel Johnson said. Often by sending gifts, by sending letters, by sending notes, and often the gift would be accompanied by a little poem like this.
Nice.
A day, help, another day. Your prayers, O passerby, from such a common ball as this might date a victory. From marshallings as simple, the flags of nations swing. Steady, my soul, what issues upon thine arrowhead?
Yeah, what issues? So that's, why don't you describe what you think it's about?
Well, it just sounds like we've got another day. What's going to be great about this? What kind of victory are we going to have? Are we going to have war? Are we going to have some great battle won, or what? What issues upon my
ear? Mm-hmm. So you're seeing some irony in there, kind of a sardonic. Mm-hmm. Could be there. I have often read that poem aloud, and I have usually, I think this is a very interesting interpretation, I've usually taken it to be her sense of exuberance, her sense of just. No, she never would say just a day, she would say a day, especially a day like this.
Let's keep that in mind, because I think what would be fun to do is to have each of you do it afterwards.
Okay.
In two different ways.
Okay.
But one is the sense of exuberance, and one is a much more qualified and a greeting to the day, and questioning the value of the day and wondering what good can come of it. I think that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll just have the two of you do it in two different ways. Interesting. And let's see, why don't you just read this?
If you were coming in the fall, I'd brush the summer by with half a smile and half a spurn as housewives do a fly. If I could see you in a year, I'd wind the months in balls and put them each in separate drawers, for fears the numbers fuse. If only centuries delayed, I'd count them on my hand, subtracting till my fingers dropped into Van Diemen's hand. If certain when this life was out that yours and mine should be, I'd toss it yonder like a rind and take eternity. But now, uncertain of the length of this that is between, it goads me like the goblin bee that will not state its sting.
Yeah. That's very clear. What is Van Diemen's?
Well, she often picked geographical places like Van Diemen's Land, or yeah, Tunis, or Brazil, in mentioned three poems that we treated last week. And it's an unknown, romantic, far away, mysterious place.
Uh-huh. I purposely read Diamond's Land because die, to die.
Fine.
Uh huh. So that would be.
I figured it was probably Demons.
Or Shangri-La.
Yeah.
It's a place that she's heard mm-hmm. of, but she doesn't know where it is, and it's kind of exotic.
Yeah, Shangri-La.
Far
yeah.
away.
I think, was it not the name given by Abel Tasman to the parts of Australia that he found when he was out looking for Terra Incognito in the South Seas?
I think so.
Yeah. So it's a very specific, unknown, and uh-huh. thought to be really majestic, promising place.
And how much she knew about what it specifically was is uncertain.
Yeah.
Because she often picked these places and she would have lists of them that were just kind of a dramatic name for a place. She talks about a hummingbird as having come and gone. Where'd he go? Where did he come from? Maybe he brought the mail from Tunis. He moves so fast that it just, zzz, he's there, with the mail from Tunis, zzz, he's gone back to Tunis. Why don't we go over to the other side? Why don't you take us, Robert, and
okay.
we'll come back to this side.
There is a languor of the life, more imminent than pain. 'Tis pain's successor. When the soul has suffered all it can. A drowsiness diffuses, a dimness like a fog, envelops consciousness as mists obliterate a crag. The surgeon does not blanch at pain, his habit is severe, but tell him that it ceased to feel the creature lying there. And he will tell you, skill is late, a mightier than he, has ministered before him, there's no vitality.
So what do you see the status of the individual?
Dying.
Yeah, I think probably.
Dying is as a go at the surgeon at the same time.
Beyond pain.
Yeah, depression.
Well, but no.
Depressing.
No.
So.
You don't think so?
No, I think the fog of consciousness envelops and helps.
Mm-hmm. Sounds to me like she had given up. This is it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it's depressing. I mean, I think I agree with you that it's the end, but mm-hmm. it seems to me to be more acceptance.
I don't
than
see it as depressing at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, see, the end depresses me, so it's how it affects us in our own life, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going.
A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him. Did you not his notice? Sudden is. The grass divides us with a comb, a spotted shaft is seen. Then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn, yet when a boy and barefoot I more than once at noon have passed, I thought, a whiplash, unbraiding in the sun when stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me, I feel for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow attended or alone without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone.
Yeah. What's that?
Brings to mind a snake in the grass.
Yeah.
Right on.
Great description.
What about zero at the bone? What do you make of zero at the bone? Knees are loose.
Yeah.
A student one time when I asked that question said, well, when you see a bone in section, it's like a zero.
Yeah.
Right.
Like that. Yeah. So it's calling attention to that section of the bone that's the center of your support is all of a sudden not there.
Yeah. So it's about spine crawl.
Yeah, it's a wonderful metaphor. It's a wonderful metaphor. Zero at the bone.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. That one.
Okay.
Should we come back over here?
Okay.
This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me.
What do you think the letter to the world is?
I just thought it was your life. And maybe it had a little bit of the philosophy of that poem.
That. Right on.
Uh-huh. The world never wrote to me.
Yeah.
So I'm not some big somebody.
Right.
But hopefully it'll judge tenderly of me.
When do you think that might happen?
After she's gone.
Yeah.
Which they did.
It's a kind of prescient poem. Mm-hmm. Because it's often used as an introductory poem for anthologies or for selections of her poems. Because the letter to the world then might be interpreted, you see, as being her poetry. And she's sending it out to the world, and the world has never acknowledged it. There were 7 of her poems that were published during her lifetime, and the reaction was not very significant. And they were changed, which broke her heart, because she worked so hard. Poets hate to have a word changed, you know, because they work so hard to put it exactly the way they want it, and somebody else changes it. And even those of us who write in prose get mad enough. And, change that. That's the way I wrote it. The poets get furious. She got absolutely livid with anger when they changed her poems. And so she retained them all, and her sister found them after she'd gone and arranged that they be published. And when they came out, of course, there was a terrific response. It was an immediate and overwhelming response. So in a way, the poem was a wonderful summary of her artistic experience. Love it. Mm-hmm. Betty, what do you got?
It's all I have to bring today. This and my heart beside. This and my heart and all the fields and all the meadows wide. Be sure you count, should I forget someone, the sum could tell. This and my heart and all the bees which in the clover dwell. Hmm. What's this?
What do you think? What do you think, Betty?
It could be the poem. It's her ability. It's her gift to the world. So.
Yeah. I mean, I could see it. Betty doing it as a picture.
Or could be anyone bringing a gift to someone that they think is, you know, some bakery goods or any little humble gift, I would think, where you could come and
exactly the way it was used.
This is all I bring today, but my heart's in it.
It too. Yeah. It too was used with a gift, Betty. Exactly as you say. So you're right on. She sent it along with a little present that she sent to a friend.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I heard it completely, but to me I was thinking it was complete devotion.
It could be.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the way she was completely devoted. I'll give you everything. I'm not only giving you this little cake that I have baked for you and sending to you via a servant or a sister or a friend, but this is simply an earnest of the utter devotion that I feel for you. It's symbolic of what I would do for you, which is anything. I would do anything for you. I would give anything to you. Lovely thing to receive with a gift. The gift couldn't possibly be up to the poem.
Let's do yours. What is your name?
Joan.
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 Do yours.
All right. One sister have I in our house, and one a hedge away. There's only one recorded, but both belong to me. One came the road that I came and wore my last year's gown. The other, as a bird in her nest, builded our hearts among. She did not sing as we did. It was a different tune. Herself to her and music, as bumblebee of June. Today is far from childhood, but up and down the hills, I held her hand the tighter, which shortened all the miles. It's written about her sister-in-law, because she did have a sister.
Yeah.
I'm struck that so often she refers to June and bumblebees and things of nature. That seems to be one of her big themes. Summer?
Yes, yep. Indeed. She loved nature.
Yeah.
She loved nature.
And if ever you lived in Massachusetts, you know that it's awfully nice to have summer come.
Right.
Come the bugs.
Yes, it is indeed.
So I think that's very clear, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
It's a very straightforward poem.
Right.
Having two sisters.
Right.
She was a sister-in-law.
How neat. She was thrilled with her sister-in-law. I mean,
yeah.
They became dear friends.
Yeah.
For a while.
For a while. Okay. I have to read more then. I couldn't get it all read at one time.
Her relationship with the sister-in-law and then was cataclysmic.
Is that right? Did she disappoint her? Is that why? Because Sue became her critic, it says.
Yes, and she proved to be a very unsatisfactory person, measured however.
I see.
She was a disastrous wife to her dear, dear brother.
Uh-huh.
And she was a mess.
But this was in the happy time.
All right.
This was in the happy early years when, indeed, Emily Dickinson was
1856.
Very devoted to her. Devoted to her.
Yes,
devoted to her.
I want to get through them all because then I want to pair them up and do a little work on them, and then we'll do them again.
Okay, we'll do them again, or we do them again another time, or
no, we'll do them again.
Go ahead.
We're gonna get it on its feet.
Okay.
We lose people. You know, people go away and things like that.
Okay.
Not have it
fun.
Happen. So, Jan, do you want to read your poem? Mm-hmm.
Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires the sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated, dying on whose forbidden ear, the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. Now that seems very serious to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is this war we're talking about here?
Certainly the metaphor is war. Mm-hmm. The metaphor is war, success being equated with victory in the war,
mm-hmm.
failure being equated with being vanquished in the war. So in
and
that
then
sense, right?
Hearing those triumphant sounds while you're dying.
Yes, but you know, it could be athletics.
It could be anything that's
it could be anything where, yeah, where there's a competition, mm-hmm. there's a clear victor and also a clear loser. I mean,
that's right.
But we were walking across this pretty little stadium in Seattle, that's at Seattle Center, it's right next to the Opera House. And there was a track meet, high school track meet going on that time, and we just walked across it, and there was this, you know, beautiful 17-year-old young man who had obviously just lost. And he was so despondent. And you didn't see anybody whose sense of elation from having won had the same amount of emotion as this young man who was just sitting there with his,
really,
you know,
and realize what a victory was.
Yeah, and so he's the one who knew,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. the guy who won, I'm sure, was happy. But
and he went to look for his girlfriend.
What
the heck?
But this and the, you know, the pain of loss
mm-hmm.
was so profound. Bill, let's be
sure. I have one I totally don't understand.
Oh, good.
Good.
I'll stand up.
Standing up's a good instinct, by the way, if you're trying to be understood and clear. So feel free to do it if you if you'd like to do it. I instinctively want to stand up so I can be heard.
For me, it's necessity to be heard.
Yeah.
Frame of myself to justify all other plotted be superfluous, an incense beyond necessity. Fame of myself to lack, although my name be else supreme. This was an honor, honorless, a further diadem.
A further what?
Diadem.
Further?
Diadem.
Is it further?
Yeah. Pardon me. Futile.
Futile.
That's a little, you know what I said? A futile diadem. I don't know what it means.
But sounds like a discouraged actor.
Well, why is he discouraged?
Because there's no praise.
From whom?
Well, I guess when he's watching it.
Oh, well, I was in a performance, and I got lots of praise. Accolades from everyone. Reviews were perfect.
Okay, it's from himself, eh? Yeah.
So I knew. So I say, well, it's nice to have your compliments, folks. And I accept them gracefully because I've learned that that's the way you have to do it. But since we're in family here, let me tell you, as critics, you flashed it. Because I was not what I ought to do.
It does make sense.
Can you read it again?
Yeah, sure, let's do it again.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
Yeah, you need that. Or at least for me.
Yeah.
Frame of myself to justify all other plotted.
Excuse me, Bill. The first word we need to hear.
Frame. Frame.
Or fame.
It says here, frame.
Does it? That's a miss. Mm-hmm. That's a typo.
Fame.
Maybe that's why I was
saying fame. It's got to be fame.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Fame. Never noticed that it's miss.
Yeah,
it's got to be fame.
That's why I threw me. Really.
Fame.
Fame of myself to justify all other plaudit be superfluous, an incense beyond necessity. And here's the next one. It's okay. Fame of myself to lack, although my name be else supreme. This was an honorless, a futile diadem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I'll tell you, it was that frame that really
hit. Yes, understandably. Yes.
Well, that's for publishers, they use the wrong word.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough.
That changed
the whole point.
Crumbling is not an instance act, a fundamental cause. Dilapidations, processes, are organized decays. 'Tis first a cobweb on the soul, a cuticle of dust, a bore in the axis, an elemental rust. Ruin is formal, devil's work, consecutive and slow. Fail in an instant, no man did. Slipping is crash's law.
Yeah.
It sounds like things just don't happen. There's a history behind it, all leading up to what happened.
Yeah.
It doesn't just happen, does it? Mm-hmm. We've all known people who are apparently magnificent successes by any measure, and all of a sudden the wheels come off, and we say, how could that possibly happen? Mm-hmm. But then we learn. There was a problem.
Well, they just didn't keep their checkbook up. And
and why was that? Go all the way back to the womb. Go back to the genes. Go back to the ambience in which they were brought up as tiny children.
That's right.
Okay, let's have yours.
Eden is that old-fashioned house we dwell in every day, without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair, on looking back, the day we sauntered from the door, unconscious our returning, discover it no more.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Well, I don't know, to me it's sort of like we We don't appreciate the present until it becomes the past. And then we look, but we can't recapture it once we try to go back.
Does it start out Eden, E-D-E-N?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Should we hear it one more time?
Yeah, let's hear it one more time. That's really fun.
Eden is that old-fashioned house we dwell in every day, without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair, I'm looking back, the day we sauntered from the door, unconscious our returning, discover it no more.
Well, could it be Adam and Eve out of the garden and bringing it in modern-day language, but when they wanted to go back, it wasn't there for them anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's almost even, it can be even simpler. I think it's just, when we're children, we just accept everything, and when we grow up,
we
try to go back and find it to be.
Can't go home.
Yeah,
can't
go home again. Yeah, interesting.
But things that looked wonderful don't look wonderful anymore.
Yeah.
You've grown beyond it, or you've grown up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's have yours. This is easy and it's so cute, except I don't understand the last stanza.
Oh, okay.
A bird came down the walk, he did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. Then he drank a dew from a convenient grass, and then hopped sideways to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes and hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head. Like one in danger, cautious, I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home. Now, I don't understand this. Then oars divide the ocean to silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap splashless as they swim.
Splashless?
Yes, but that's a bird, and birds aren't in the water. I don't understand the last.
Well, it really, the poem turns around right about in the middle there. Yeah, I think you read it beautifully. The first verses are very straightforward observations of a bird. What kind of bird do you think it is?
A robin.
Sounds like a robin, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds like a robin to me. It's just an observation of the robin, and it's kind of got a cute, regular rhythm. Mm-hmm. Your word cute is right on. That's just the way it seems to me to be, too. Then, about halfway through the poem, the direction becomes a lot more serious, doesn't it?
Well, he's like one in danger.
Yeah.
Cautious, I offered him a crumb. He unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home. And then the oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap splashless as they swim. I didn't get the end of it.
Right. Well, it's certainly a lot more abstruse, a lot more kind of metaphysical. What we're dealing with there, I think, as I interpret the poem, is the terror of being a bird, the constant danger of which the bird has to be aware. So when the bird leaves and heads out, it goes where? We don't have any idea where it goes, but it is motivated in its fleeing by terror and heads into the unknown, and the unknown is a frightening place for the bird, because the danger is going to be there too. It's real identification with the bird. Mm-hmm. So we're led into a place that she often uses the word, and it's suggested here, circumference. Way, way out there, where that bird has gone, but wherever it goes, it's going to be the captive of terror. Because if it's not terrified all the time, it's not going to persist. She's got another poem about a couple of butterflies that have the same thing. They go off to circumference, and we don't know where they go. And we think we understand the bird, but once we have a sense of the bird's terror, we realize we don't know the bird, because we don't know that terror. We can't know quite that kind of physical terror almost every moment.
That fits with the symbol, the bird is a universal symbol for the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so, where does the soul go? and the terror of the unknown, or the obscure, and the circumference of the infinity or something.
Yeah,
or
something. Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. I like that. That's really good. Yeah.
And the, in Egypt, the bird is a symbol of the soul. And dreams.
And in China, it's the butterfly, isn't it?
The butterfly, yeah, is similar in some sense. Yeah.
Well, she kind of links the butterfly and the bird here.
Yeah.
Butterfly comes out of a metamorphosis, too. Right.
Caterpillar.
Yeah.
So, a very simple, straightforward, a bird came down the walk, he scarcely knew what he saw, he bit an angle worm in half, made the fella raw, and then he drank grass from a convenient dew, and then starts to get a little more observant of the bee. And when I offered him a crumb, then he's up and he's gone, and now we're in a world of kind of terror and unknown and uncertainty, and it's the direction of the poem is so dramatically switched. It's a powerful poem, I think.
But she also was, what's the word for my, let's see, she was a rebel from the Presbyterian, very solid beliefs and so on, which have made things all certain, and, you know, and even defied that or
Absolutely.
So this sort of really makes a statement about the uncertainty.
You can identify with the bird.
Yeah.
How the bird feels.
She felt that way too.
Take your poem. Will you be here next tomorrow?
We leave tomorrow.
Oh, just Annie, we just won't let him go. I'm sorry about that.
They're
fine
in a room.
One will never get solved.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you. That was lovely.
Bye.
So we have two more, do we not, Annie?
We have two more. These two?
Whichever.
Yeah. I could bring you jewels that I am mine to. But you have enough of those. I could bring you odors from St. Domingo, colors from Veracruz, berries of the Bahamas have I. But this little blaze, flickering to itself in the meadow, suits me more than those. Never a fellow matched this topaz in his emerald swing. Dower itself from Bobadilla. Better could I bring? It isn't these big, wonderful, beautiful gifts that are important. It's the small, little, everyday things that are important.
Yeah, she has lots of those. Usually they did indeed go with a present, and they have that. But they're always fresh. She's never repetitive. It always has an insight that kind of takes your breath away with its thoughtfulness and its precision of language.
Jan, when we just right. It's kind of cute by two in some way. God made a little gentian. It tried to be a rose and failed. All the summer laughed, but just before the snows, there rose a purple creature that ravished all the hill, and summer hid her forehead, and mockery was still. The frosts were her condition. The Tyrian would not come until the north invoke it. Creator, shall I bloom?
Is it gentian?
Gentian
flower?
G-E-N-T-I-A.
Yeah.
There's a
gentian
violet.
Yeah. Well, we're getting sort of tight on time. But what I wanted to do was to sort of couple some of these poems together and sort of give a context to them, because an imaginary context, but sometimes it just helps to illuminate and kind of open up some of the interpretations if you put them into a situation. I mean, this is the way I work as a director, so. But who will not be here tomorrow? Because we should do yours today.
Okay. So what would yours was one of the gift poems, right? Big part. Wait, which one's your poem?
This is my letter to the world.
Yeah,
this
one
is
of the
my
gift
letter
ones.
To the world.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me just go over how I think we might try to do them tomorrow. I think it's the best way to do it.
Sure.
Yeah. And then we'll do yours. We'll just give you a context too, and so then everybody will see how it will work. Let's have the two death poems done together. Okay. And you can just think about how they can work pairing them both, because I think they'd be interesting to do together, and I think it would kind of illuminate them.
I'm not sure what you're asking. Do you want us?
We'll simply read.
You just read them.
We'll read them tomorrow.
We'll
read them tomorrow. If you can be here, of course. If you can't, then that's we'll just.
Do we hang on to these?
Yeah, sure.
Hang on to the sheets, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
You take the books along if you want, or just pick them up again tomorrow. They'll
just
all be here tomorrow.
I mean, you don't have to
read. Do a dialogue or whatever. We are
is your
what?
Session
read?
At 2? Tomorrow our session is at... Tomorrow our session is next in the room next door. And it's at 3:30, same time.
Oh, okay.
And it's just in the room next door, and I just think it'd be fun to do all the poems again in a sort of context, and then we can watch this video on Emily Dickinson's life.
Mm-hmm.
Because the work is so nice. Really kind of nice. I think, why don't you and Robert just talk about it and decide however you want to do those two poems.
So we would read them again.
Read them again, yeah.
And then any observations that you may want to make, the two of you, if you've had a chance to think about them together, and what comes out of it.
I mean, obviously, one is a poem said by a person who's dying, and one is a poem said about somebody who's dying. And it's an observation. So it seems to me that's kind of interesting to put the two of them together. And then let's have the 2 day poems, a day. Have you two do them with entirely different attitudes toward what you think a day is. And then we have a number of gift poems. We have, let's see, yours was a gift poem, and we have I Could Bring You is a gift poem. And we have another gift poem.
Hers was a gift, wasn't it?
This is all. This is all I have to bring today?
Pardon me?
It was Betty's. Right.
Betty.
So, I could bring you... Oh, I guess it was... Whose was that?
Betty.
Let's see. Betty's
gone. What was yours?
Mine is the...
Success
the one
is kind of
success.
Success.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But wasn't yours... I could bring you jewels.
I could bring you jewels, right.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah. So let's just put you at a birthday party and choose somebody to have be their birthday party or whatever kind of party you want it to be, and you're bringing presents. Okay?
Okay.
Now, I don't know. I think I would love to see you try if you should come in the winter or whatever, however that goes. I'd love to see you try that as a love poem.
Can you come away with that?
So you find some man in the class you want to say the poem to.
If you were coming in the fall.
If you were coming in the fall.
Maybe your husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always available.
He's here.
Maybe he has a love poem, yeah.
Uh-huh. Right, it sounds like that.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So find and then actually say it to that person. It will change your reading,
uh-huh.
I think.
Okay.
And someone said we lost the snake and the bird came down the walk, which I thought was just going to work so wonderfully together.
The animal.
It's
going to
be our nature. Yeah, our little nature, nature class. Now let's see. One sister. Will one sister, I have one sister at home and one next door, work with Eden? It seems to me. me they might want to give it.
Yeah.
I'm sister.
Oh, your sister.
Mm-hmm. I think those two poems are
yeah, great.
Well, I think they could reverberate back and forth.
Yeah.
The other, yeah.
So just sort of think about how you want to do this. Yes.
All right.
I'm going to erase all this.
May I read yours?
Certainly.
And you want to read mine?
Certainly.
Thank you.
And I think your two poems work together, interestingly yeah. enough.
Success and fame.
Yeah, success and fame. I mean, it's, she's talking about losing, and you're saying, well, listen, even when you win, it's not so great. crumbling is not an instance. Would you like to try that as a speech to a group of people living in Holden Village who you want to have get busy painting up the place and fixing it up? And we'll all be the people at the meeting. And the gentian also works as a gift poem, doesn't it?
Could be, sure, isn't it?
Join the ladies at the party.
Oh.
Who are the ladies at the party?
You're one of the ladies at the party.
Mm-hmm. And think, yeah.
To me, that's yeah. what of blossoming through adversity.
Yes, yeah, I think that's
yeah. not having blossomed at all is what I read into it.
Well, until the spring came, the snows came, then it came out.
It didn't bloom until winter.
Yeah.
So after the hardships of winter, the other flowers bloomed before, but it waited until the hardship of winter.
As soon as it bloomed, it was covered up.
But just before the snow.
Uh-huh. Why don't you live with it and decide what you want to do with it? Mm.